Hello there, friends, and welcome back to another episode of Football Manager Therapy. I am your host, Rich Owens, and joining me this week, we have another two-thirds of the FM team. This week, Callum has gone to a wedding, so he's put some photos online in his little suit. Some of us are a lot more excited about that than others, but joining me this week, we have the United City FM, we have Kev, and we have Jebaru, who's back from his travels. Kev, yes. How are you this morning, pal?
I'm all right, thank you. I was saying to you before we started, I have these moments where sometimes disability stuff kicks my backside a little bit. I've got a couple of those at the moment. They're not stopping me functioning. They're not stopping me being here. It's all good, but just one or two bits. So I'd love to say I'm amazingly brilliant. I might not be quite that, but I'm good, and I'm happy to see you two, and it's going to be a lovely hour or so that we get to spend some time together.
Absolutely. You know what, mate? I will take good. Good is good. We will take good any day of the week. Lovely to have you with us this morning, pal. Jeb, you're here. You're back. Ryanair have delivered you. How are we, mate?
Yeah, not so bad. It's been a long time. Yeah, it's been a long time. Like, I'm trying to figure out how long I've been away. I think it's over 6 weeks I've been in and out. I think this is the longest period I'll spend at home, which is a nice 10 days away from Berlin and all the gaming and all the esports and stuff like that. But while I've been away, it's been really fun, and I'm really keen to talk about it this week. I've been doing loads of training schedule stuff and like working on that and working my way through, and I think it's really important to focus on training schedules and how you do those and how it affects players and how different tweaks and how you can build them, maybe even do it on stream as well and interact with your community. So I'm looking forward to that. Guys?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Kev, do you want to tell him?
Awkward.
Yeah. It's a bit,
Even got a name for the episode as well. Pepe Trainer. You know,
oh, that's really good. That's if we were going to record a podcast about training, that's probably what I would call it. In hindsight,
did you happen to catch last week's?
No, I've been far too busy.
Callum talked about training last week, Jeb. Sorry about that, mate.
Of course, he did.
Bless him. I mean, you know, he just couldn't help himself. It kind of came out and did this whole long spiel about, you know, doing stuff on streams and getting your community to interact more with you in the game and doing more abroad. We tried to reel him in, Jeb, you know, we tried to, but he just kind of went off on one.
See where this is going. It's fine. How are you then, Rich? How are you, huh?
Yeah, well, I'm all right. Thank you for asking, mate. Yeah, I suppose. Suppose I'm okay, about as okay as I can be. I've had a bit of a week away from making content. You know, I've been looking after my dad's dog, of all things. I've been getting out early in the morning, walking a stupid dog for my own stupid mental health, and as it turns out, kind of enjoying it.
Are you going to get a dog now?
No. The last thing I'm going to do now is get a dog. Oh my goodness, it's like having another smaller, hairier child is what it is. It's just, you know, but at the same time, I'm getting up early, I'm walking this dog, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm out walking a dog, and actually this is quite nice because I'm out and I'm getting some exercise and I'm getting some fresh air, and it feels like it's a really sensible start to the day. And getting home, my wife's like, oh, was that a nice dog walk, Rich? And I just have to say, No, because I don't want her to be right, because she said it would do me good. And
you could do with some therapy, Rich. You know, Football Manager therapy. We're here for you, mate.
Thank you, boys. I appreciate that.
So
Kev's here for you. Sorry, I'm just fuming about this training thing coming.
Just as a spoiler for everybody out there, we often have a little conversation beforehand about what we're doing. We come up with a running order and stuff. The running order you've been sent, Rich. Scrap it, mate. Scrap it. It feels like you could do with some therapy. It feels like you could do with getting some stuff off your chest. So I'm going to take over. Myself and Jebaru, we've had a bit of a chat. We need to know who we're podcasting with. And I don't know if I really feel like I know you, Rich. I mean, like, properly know you. So we're going to take over and we're going to ask you some questions, if that's okay with you, my friend, and just, you know, find out everything to do with Rich Owens. So
22 episodes and my podcast has been taken away from me. I'm surprised it's taken this long.
If I'm me too. So first question, what's your bank details? No. Mm-hmm.
That's three
for later. That'll do. Okay, fair enough. Okay, so yeah, we are going to do this. Now, myself and Jebaru are quite a big fan of a pretty well-known podcast out there called The Diary of a CEO. Stephen Bartlett, great podcast. If you haven't gone and listened to any of that, please do. There's loads of great guests. But he always roughly starts in the same place. And I'm going to nick it and start in the same place for this one. And I'm going to say, Rich, what can little Rich tell us in terms of looking back at your childhood that's going to help us to understand who Big Rich now is? So where were you born? What's your family size like? What was childhood like? Tell us all about little Rich, and that will help us to understand Big Rich.
Just to confirm, Little Rich isn't the rock and roll artist or
Little Richard,
or something else. Yeah, else. No, we're talking about when you were younger. Yeah,
Sure. I mean, yeah, young Rich did have dreams of being involved in a plane crash with a big bopper as well. So it would have tied in really nicely. Look, there's my. God, this really is therapy now, isn't it?
It is.
So my family life is just this whole massive, it's a bit of a mess, I suppose, my family life, I suppose, just logistically more than anything else, less emotionally, just logistically. So some people know this about me, some people don't. I was adopted when I was very, very little. My biological family, my mom was very, very young when she had me, and they weren't able to look after a baby. So I was put up for adoption. I was adopted by lovely, lovely family. I was born in Malvern, which is a little village kind of just outside of Worcester, about an hour away from Birmingham, if we're doing big geography. And then I was adopted by a family from literally 5 miles down the road. So grew up very, very close to where I was born. Ended up kind of in Worcester when I was older, which is where I am based now and still am. It's a nice city. We've got a cathedral. We've got a TK Maxx. What more can you ask for from a big city apart from other amenities? No Burger King, though, which I'm furious about. So I've kind of ended up here. I ended up meeting my biological family that put me up for adoption some years ago, and they're all lovely, really, really, really nice people. Anybody who came to the FMT live show in Nottingham, you would have met my youngest brother. He's significantly bigger than me. His name's Ewan. He's got lots of ginger hair. He is at University in Nottingham. He came to see the live podcast, and he came and hung out with everybody afterwards. So he was a joy. I've got brothers. I've got sisters. I've got older stepbrothers. I've got younger stepbrothers. I've got a whole mess of nonsense family-wise. It's weird and it's complicated and it's confusing, but it's also mine. So yes, that's the family side of things, I guess, Kev. Most people were just expecting a more straightforward answer, weren't they? Yeah, born in Worcester, lived here for a whole time, only have two parents, because I'm normal. But no,
but you see, this is the point. This is the point. I want to know Rich Owens, and I obviously didn't in the way that maybe I should have by now. So I didn't know that. So just for a little bit of context, I have one of my siblings is adopted into our family. For info. Was that always kind of an open thing? Your new family, as it were. Talked to you a lot about from very young ages and all that kind of stuff, never kind of suppressed or hidden. How did you grow up knowing that that was the case? Has it always just been?
Yeah. It was always out in the open. It was, I think, as soon as I was old enough to understand the core concept, they were just very, very open and honest with me about it, which I think is, if I was going to do that, if I was going to adopt, that is the same thing that I would want to do with my child, because I think it's only right that they know and that they understand. Generally speaking, the way I've always looked at it is that I was incredibly lucky to be, you know, to be put up for adoption, because, you know, as part of the job that I do, I work at a local high school and I'm a family support officer, and I help kids in difficult situations a lot of the time. That's a lot of what I do. And, you know, some of the situations that some of the kids find themselves in, it can be pretty horrible. And, you know, the way that I look at my set of circumstances is that, you know, if I was 16 and I'd had a baby, I wouldn't know the first thing to do. And I can appreciate how incredibly difficult that would have been. And I think it's a really mature and sensible decision to say, okay, I'm not physically or emotionally capable of handling this, but there are people out there that want this that can't. And I think I'd like to help them. And, you know, I'm very, very lucky to be put in the circumstances that I was put in, you know, because if a child has been put up for adoption, it's not an easy thing to do. It takes years and years and years to adopt. So it just means those are people who are desperate for a child and want to love and raise that child. So from that point of view, I couldn't be any luckier in that respect. You know, you're not adopted by accident. Let's put it that way. So, yeah, that's they were always super open and honest with me about it. And I think it was just one of those things that you go, okay, these are the circumstances that I'm in. This is the situation. It's fine. And it just kind of becomes, it doesn't dominate every day. It's not something that you're always thinking about. It's just something that you are aware of. And once you're aware of it, you can process that information. And like I say, there wasn't a negative to it. So I'm glad that I knew, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm.
Jeb, so. It's fun. It's good. This is fun. You can grill him. Yeah. Ask him anything.
I think on your side of things, you grew up in Malvern. You live in Worcester. Mm-hmm. Sheffield Wednesday, eh?
yeah. Sheffield Wednesday. Yeah, it's... If anything, I think it was just my two older brothers or my two older stepbrothers just viciously bullying me. So the Sheffield Wednesday thing, it's that I have no connection to Sheffield as a city. I have no family there, no kind of connections to it in any way, shape or form. But when it comes to the club that I support, it's something as simple as my first footballing memory, which is really weird because like Jebber, I'm only 24. But for some reason, I have some kind of vague recollection of Italian 90, which is just really, really weird because that doesn't make any sense because that's far too early. But my biggest standout recollection from Italian 90 was a fella called Chris Waddle and his stunning mullet. And I don't remember much else about the tournament or the football or anything else, but that always stuck out in my mind. And I became a little bit of a Chris Waddle fan without really much additional context. Fast forward to a couple of years later, around 1992, 93, my older brothers, my older stepbrothers, who are both diehard West Brom fans, they said, Rich, you need to pick a team to support. And I said, well, I support England because of course I do. And they said, no, there are other teams in England. You need to choose one to support. And I went, okay, who should I support? Because I had absolutely no idea. I don't think at that point I probably could have named more than two football clubs, one of them being England. And they said, okay, well, do you still like Chris Waddle? And I said, yes. And they said, well, Chris Waddle plays for Sheffield Wednesday, so you can support them. So I said, okay, and that was it. That was it. There's nothing deeper to it. Had it been a couple of years either way, I could have been a Spurs fan, I could have been a Marseille fan, but no, Sheffield Wednesday. And I stuck with it for whatever reason. I just decided to stick with it. You don't see too many Wednesday fans in the Midlands, if I'm honest with you, but whenever I do get a little bit excited. It's just rare. It's like rare and exotic for me. I was out for dinner with friends a couple of weeks ago and a guy walked past the restaurant we were sat in a way. He was wearing a Wednesday shirt, so I ran out the door and just shouted up the owls at him, and he looked really confused and he just kept walking. I was like, these are the special moments that we have as just fans of a terrible Yorkshire-based football club. It's brilliant.
So please tell me at some point you have grown the mullet. Is there photographic evidence of this if you did?
I wanted to. I was desperate to, but I wasn't allowed to. It was, yeah, I think when I got a little bit older and I was like, even after he had the mullet cut off, I was still like, no, this is the peak hairstyle. This is the one. And for about 3 years, my dad just insisted on coming. Every time I went to the barbers, my dad insisted on coming with me, and he'd sit there. He'd be like, short back and sides. And they were like, oh, okay. And I was like, no, don't do that. I want to look like Chris Waddle. And they're like, no, your dad's really scary. We're just going to give you short back and sides. And that was it. So, and then I grew out of it. Ironically, it's back now. Kids have got the mullet. I say, I work in a high school, and there are a significant number of kids who have got one. But, you know, they don't pay homage to Chris Waddle in any way, shape, or form. So, realistically, have they actually got a mullet? These are, I don't think it counts.
I'm also guessing that you weren't shown the penalty shootout or anything like that as well. That World
what Cup. Penalty shootout? No, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, there wasn't one.
That's fine.
That's what that was. Pain.
Mm-hmm. But hey, you know what? It got to a Pizza Hut advert with Gareth Southgate and Stuart Pearce many years later. So, and at that point, he needed the money, I reckon. So, yeah, what a guy.
So, growing up, watching football, liking Chris Waddle, getting into Sheffield mm-hmm. Wednesday, were you overly sporty yourself? Were you involved in sport at all?
I wanted to be involved in football because I loved football. Like that was always my go-to up until the age of about, you know, 12, 13. Like every waking second that I had available, I would try to be playing football in some capacity. I moved schools quite a lot when I was younger. I went to quite a number of different kind of, you know, primary and secondary schools. So I was never really at one long enough to kind of establish myself at a school as a decent sports person. So I always wanted to play football for schools, but I just never got the opportunity because by the time I start at a new school, they had like an established school football team for that year group, and it was impossible to just get involved because they had the starting 11 who were really good, and then nobody else ever really got a look in. I played, for whatever reason, I played rugby for about 6 years. I do not like rugby. I do not enjoy rugby. I don't like watching rugby. And if there's one thing I dislike more than watching rugby, it's playing rugby. I played it for 6 years, and I can say, hand on heart, this is an open and honest admission. I do not understand the rules of rugby. I do not understand anything about it. I played it every other weekend for 6 years, had no idea what was going on. The only thing I knew is that you had to throw the ball sideways or backwards, and that was it. I was a winger, so I was right down the end of the line. The ball very rarely made it out to the wings, so I would spend about an hour jogging up and down a touchline in the rain on a Sunday morning, not really involved in the game very much, which suited me, if I'm honest with you, because I didn't really want to be. But yeah, I played rugby for 6 years, did not enjoy it, wished I could have been playing football instead. But my dad wasn't massively sporty himself. So he, even though I had the, you know, the interest and the passion, the want to play football, he didn't like football. So he wasn't as invested in helping me do it, whereas rugby he was a little bit more interested in. So he was willing to kind of, you know, drive me to places and take me to, you know, training sessions, whatever else it was. He was more invested. He was happier to do that because he thought rugby was better than football. So he was happy to take part in that respect. But yeah, wish I could have played more football, but, you know, I played enough with my friends, I think, to kind of, you know, just, you know, sate my appetite, I suppose. But never for a club or anything like that. I would have liked to, but
yeah. I think we'll go a little more serious, I guess. But mm-hmm. you a neurodiverse brain, Kev has written down just for me to ask about. what impact does it have on your life? But I think you've been quite open with it. You do suffer from autism. You are on the spectrum, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I think that's the easiest way to put it. Yeah. Like, how does that affect your day-to-day life, and then just even just like into bringing it around to Football Manager and then to streaming mm-hmm. and things like that as well, and then obviously the podcast?
Sure. I mean, day-to-day, it's a weird thing. I've talked about this before, so apologies if anybody's listening to this, like, Rich, just stop going on about it. I only found out that I was on the spectrum, I think it was just before lockdown. So it was only about 3 years ago, I think, that I kind of got my diagnosis. And then lockdown happened, and all of the kind of ongoing support that they talked about that they were going to put in place for me in the long run. There was a global pandemic, and as it turns out, they've been quite busy since. So, so in terms of like kind of day-to-day life, I'm still kind of having to remind myself, which I know sounds like such a stupid thing because it's the kind of thing that you would think would always be kind of at the forefront of your brain. But I do have to remind myself quite frequently that that's the case. I was having this conversation with my wife not long ago, actually. It's like looking at it as a broader thing. I'm still not particularly good at understanding myself. For her birthday early this year, my wife and I both love Fern Brady, Scottish stand-up comedian. She's absolutely fantastic, and very much like me, she's only been recently diagnosed with autism. She's written an autobiography recently called Strong Female Character. I got it for my wife for her birthday, and she loves it because it's a really, really interesting read. But she took it on her honeymoon with us, and we're sat on the plane. I'm sat next to her, and she's just like reading this book. And every few seconds, she's just like turning around and looking at me and going, okay. I'm like, what's? And I'm like, read it out to me. And she would just read out this passage, and I'm like, yep, okay. So again, that ticks a lot of boxes for me. There's a thing that a lot of people who are on the autistic spectrum, I can't remember the words, and I really, really wish that I could, but it's basically, it's where you don't have the ability to, or really struggle to interpret your own kind of feelings. Like, you are not massively self-aware in that respect. You find it really, really hard to articulate and understand how you are feeling and also why you are feeling that way. And that's a big one for me. I'm not massively self-aware in terms of like my emotions. Which is something that, at least now, when it comes to that kind of thing, I still don't understand myself brilliantly. But the biggest thing for me, and I think for my family as well, is that we now understand why I don't understand myself, which before it was just very, very confused, and it was really, really weird, and we couldn't quite, we were never able to kind of like put our finger on what was going on. You know, my reaction to, you know, more serious things or sad things happening around me was never the same as other people around me. It's like, in terms of my family, in terms of friends, anything like that, my reaction to things was always quite different, and we never really knew why. But now we do, if that makes sense. It's, you know, we still don't understand the exact whys, but there's an overarching thing. That's, okay, well, we at least understand at a core level that, you know, Rich's autistic, his brain works differently, and that means that his brain is processing this event differently to everybody else's. So that's helped enormously. That's been brilliant. You know, and there's more to it. There's deeper I can go into it. And at some point I think I would like to. Mm-hmm. But for the time being, at least I kind of have, you know, the generally speaking, the why has been answered, I suppose. Mm. So that's been really, really, really helpful. In terms of things like streaming as well, I think the way that I present myself and the way that I talk and the way that, you know, I talk to people, be it in person, be it via Twitch, whatever it may be, has always been kind of similar. I don't think any of that enormously changed kind of, you know, after my diagnosis. So in terms of how I kind of present myself and conduct myself online and interact with people online, I don't think, if we were living in a world where I'd never received that diagnosis, I don't think that would have changed particularly. I think I would still present myself and interact with people in the same way. But also sometimes in certain situations, I could be like, well, actually, this may be happening. It may be happening in my chat, or somebody may have said something, or in real life, I may say something to somebody, or somebody might say something to me, and my reaction to that interaction, I can say, actually, I've reacted this way, or I don't know how to react, but I don't know how to react, or I've said what I've said because of this. And again, we try to be really open and honest about it with people. We were at a friend's house yesterday. Prime example, I was introduced to a friend of a friend's partner. Now, I don't know what I said because I wasn't really paying attention, but they said something to me and I answered them. And then the first thing I heard my wife say was, by the way, this is my husband, Rich, he's autistic. And they went, oh, okay, that's fine then. And I was like, I'm so, what did I say? I'm so sorry. I don't know. Have I said something really, really rude? And is it, apparently they all just laughed it off and said, no, it's fine. But you know, those kind of things happen. But at least now my wife could be like, hey, this is my husband, Rich, and this is why he said it. Whereas before they would have been like, what's he doing? You can't talk to straight. You can't. How dare he? So that's helped. That's helped enormously. And again, in terms of the streaming, it just means when those interactions happen, I could be like, oh, well, I don't really know how to talk about that. Or I really don't know how to respond to that because of this. So that's good. Like I said, the best thing about it for me is just being open and honest about it with people, just being able to have that conversation.
With regards to your diagnosis, though, was that something that you yourself sought, or did other people do that on your behalf, or did you just kind of stumble into it? What was the catalyst to that?
My wife kind of is amazing. She kind of started to do a bit of research. She was noticing kind of traits that I had, or certain ways that I was interacting with people, or certain things I was struggling with. And she was the one that was like, okay, there has to be more to this. This can't just be Rich. There's got to be a reason that these things are, he acts this way, or there's got to like his perception of these events is his reaction to things. There has to be a little bit more to it. So she started doing all the research. And then she was kind of like sending me bits and pieces. And she was like, look, I think that this could be a thing. And it kind of, I think a lot of it tied into after my daughter was born. So again, if you've watched any of my streams, you will know that generally about 20 minutes in, my children will invade the room and they will sit here and they will say rude words into the microphone and then they'll just march out the room, which is wonderful. And I love them both in a way. But after my daughter was born, I think I struggled. I think in hindsight, I didn't find child number two easy. I think it was a difficult transition. A lot of neurodiverse people will tell you that they rely on routine. And I'm one of those people. I need routine in my life. I need structure and I need order, because if I'm left to my own devices, I struggle enormously. There's something that ties into a lot of people that suffer from ADHD. It's called executive dysfunction, which I definitely never used to say. I'm really, really sorry, I've got erectile dysfunction, I can't do that. definitely never said that in meetings at work. That's what I have said at least three times. They look at you really, really weird. So executive dysfunction is basically your brain is trying to explain to you, you need to complete a task. But however, the way that your brain communicates is trying to communicate that to your body, it means that your body just won't let you, or your brain won't let you. It's like, right. And it's something as simple as, I haven't had any water to drink now for 24 hours. I need to go and get some water. But then your body and your brain just go, no, but how do you do that? How do you get water? Like, what's the process? You don't even understand what you do. And your brain just kind of like, bah! And then you suddenly just carry on sitting there or doing whatever you're doing without getting up and drinking the water you really, really need to drink. So that it's things that are as fundamentally basic as that, like eating, drinking, getting a bath, just washing your clothes, the fundamental basics of existing, like your brain fights against you doing. So having a second child, and at the time, the job I was doing, the role I was doing in my job had changed quite dramatically. So there's a lot of pressure on me kind of at work. And then having child number two, I just shut down. My brain just shut down and I was a bit of a ghost, and it was really, really hard for the people around me. It was hard for my wife because she was dealing with, you know, a 2-year-old, a newborn, a, you know, 24-year-old who was essentially a toddler as well, because I just wasn't looking after myself. And I think that was kind of the point where she was like, right, there is definitely something wrong and you need some help. And we need to start trying to figure out what it is. And she started doing more reading, more research. And then that's when she was like, look, I think that neurodiversity is potentially a thing for you. And it stemmed from there. It stemmed from there. Went to my GP, spoke to my GP, kind of had some appointments with them. I was then put on a waiting list for assessment at a place. I think it's called the... I think it's just called something like the Family Centre, but it's a local thing, and they deal with kind of diagnoses of like autism or neurodiversity, ranging from kids to adults. So I got put on a waiting list for them, and then eventually had the assessments with them, and that's when they came back and they said, yes. It's weird, in kids they'll go more in depth into the diagnosis. Again, I'm working with kids at the moment who are going through that. It's called the Umbrella Pathway, and it's that how they get kind of diagnosed with things like, you know, autism or just other issues in neurodiversity. With the kids, they go a little bit more in depth, because when you're younger, it's easier to tell. When you're an adult, it's just more of a blanket. You are on the autistic spectrum. And you kind of go, okay, cool, that makes sense. And they don't kind of go much deeper with it. I think you can if you really want to, but they were like, look, it's just, in adults, it's kind of a yes or a no kind of situation. There's a little bit more kind of black and white. So you don't get as much information as kind of like the real complexities or subtleties to it. Mm. But it was her that pushed for it. And telling people was actually the weirdest bit, because it wasn't like I was embarrassed or ashamed. I think it was just people's reaction to it was the weirdest thing. Mm-hmm. Most people in my life, there were two responses. There were just the people who was like, look, as it turns out, I've had this assessment and I'm autistic. And a lot of people just went, yeah, you are. And I was like, okay, cool. That's fine. And then other people, a smaller amount of people, they kind of reacted in the same way that, you know, after like the Christmas break or whatever, and then you go back to work and you're like, oh, I've put some weight on over Christmas. And they just go, no, you haven't, you look fine. No, but it's very, very clear that you've put on weight over Christmas. It was that. So like, no, it's like, you don't have to be nice about it. It's okay. I'm fine. Don't worry. It's okay to agree with me. It's okay to say that yes, you are. My stepmom was the best, because I told her it was, there was a really weird, when I got the diagnosis of being autistic, at the same time, my dad's health took a massive turn for the worse. So because he wasn't very well for quite a few years, and when I got my diagnosis, about a week later he then got kind of a diagnosis of his kind of medical issues, because he had just been kind of muddling through. And so he had Parkinson's, and he had frontal lobe atrophy as well, which is a type of dementia. So he was on two very, very different counts. Like, there was a lot going on there, and it was really, really horrible. And I thought, the last thing that I want to do is kind of just try and make it anything at this moment in time. I don't want to make anything about me, because nothing is about me. Like, it's all about my dad at the moment. So I didn't tell anybody from kind of that side of my family. Just kind of like left it. I was like, we'll have the discussion at some point. And we didn't until after my dad passed away. And waited, you know, it was about 6 months after we lost my dad. I was at my stepmom's house, and I was like, well, if I'm going to tell her, why not now? Because we're having a lovely day. We're having a lovely chat. And I told her, I was like, just so you know, Wednesday, I've had some assessments and some stuff's gone on, and just thought I should let you know that I'm neurodiverse. I'm on the autistic spectrum. And just without missing a single beat, she went, oh, darling, of course you are. And then just kind of carried on with the day. And I was like, oh, okay. I thought this was going to be not more dramatic, but I thought there was going to be at least some kind. I was expecting a follow-up question at the absolute least. And she was like, of course you are. And then just carried on. So we're like, oh, okay, cool. This is fine. This is fine. Glad I waited so long.
Well, we can be here for that. Jeb, have you got a follow-up question?
No.
Fair enough. I've got plenty. I got loads of them. So we know that you have this diagnosis. We know that it's basically been in existence right the way from day one of you, even though maybe it's not identifiable. Mm-hmm. We've also spoken about the fact that you now work in a context where potentially you can empathize with a certain level of the kids that you're now dealing with and some of the issues that they've got. Was that always your intention? Did you leave school, college, uni, whatever it is you went through there, and you can tell us about what that looked like, mm-hmm. with sure. the intention of this is where you would be and this is what you wanted to do?
Absolutely not. Not in any way, shape or form. I never really, I all the way through school, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I think a lot of my, all of my school reports, when we moved house recently, I was given just a bunch of stuff that my dad and stepmom had just been keeping hold of. I'm thinking just waiting to palm off on me, just boxes of stuff they had kept from when I was younger, stuff like school reports. And I sat there and I read through loads of them a little while ago, and every single school report read exactly the same. Has loads of potential, does not apply himself, doesn't work hard enough. What a waste. And that was it all the way through, from secondary school to like high school, like the whole way through. Has potential, doesn't apply himself, massive waste. Because at that because nobody knew. I can't, growing up, I can't think of a single person that I went to school with at any stage of my education that was kind of openly discussed as being neurodiverse, for example. It just wasn't, there may have been people, but it wasn't kind of public knowledge at any of the schools I went to, if that was the case. It's very, very easy. And it's, to be fair, it's, my dad did a lot with me. It's very easy to look at it as a, it's a laziness thing, or it's just a lack of effort thing. And there's nothing more to it than that. So buck your ideas up, try harder, work harder. Why aren't you doing these things? And that really was the important question. It was the why. Why are you struggling with these things? Because it was easy just to go, well, you're struggling because you're lazy. Stop being lazy. But there wasn't ever really a conversation about the why, which is something like, you know, if it had happened, maybe everything would have worked out very differently. Who knows? It's impossible to say. But yeah, leaving school, I did a year of sick form at my high school. I scraped just about enough GCSEs to get into my school's sick form. One of the things that I really struggle with are exams. Give me a written exam and I crumble. My brain won't allow me to do exams. I did drama at GCSE at high school. I got the highest marks possible for my coursework leading up to my GCSEs. My teacher was really, really happy. He was like, look, you barely need to do anything to come out of this with a really, really, really good grade. I ended up with an E in my drama GCSE. And I spoke to my teacher afterwards and he was like, what did you do? Because you literally would have had to have sat down, written your name incorrectly, and then written nothing for 2 hours to have come out with that grade after your coursework. And I was like, no, I sat there and I'm sure I wrote for 2 hours. And I just didn't write anything of that meant anything, apparently. And I just have always really struggled with written exams. Looking at the job that I do now, we have kids who are neurodiverse, we have autistic kids, we have kids with a variety of different learning needs, who are sitting exams at the moment, and there are allowances for them. There's extra time added for them. They are allowed to take a small amount of notes in just as jumping off points for the answer for what they need to write about in some of these situations. Had that been offered to me, it probably would have worked out very differently. Mm. You don't know, because it's the past. And because there was no discussion of, you know, neurodiversity, anything like surrounding my education, it kind of never came up. But I scraped enough results to get into my college sick form. Did the first year of A-levels. My grades were, I think, an E and two U's after my first year, because again, weirdly enough, struggled in exams. Didn't help when it's hard subject matters either. My dad's response to that was, well, if you're not going to apply yourself, basically said, if you're too stupid for sick form, there's no point you going back because you're not going to be able to fix this in year two. You can come and work for me. Because my dad used to run, he used to have a die casting factory in Birmingham city centre. And the tradition with myself and my older stepbrothers in our family, if you haven't got a job, if you're not working, you go work the factory. Mm-hmm. So I went and worked there for about 6 months and did not enjoy it at all. It was not good fun. But then after 6 months, it was called Access to Music. It was a course that was running in Worcester, and it was a 2-year music course. And all you had to do was have some vague ability to play a musical instrument. And they would probably let you onto the course. And I managed to blag my place onto that, because the one thing that I did enjoy was music. I was always quite musically focused when I was younger. I wasn't good at it, but I always enjoyed it. And then I ended up, I bought a bass guitar for a fiver from a car boot sale and kind of, you know, slowly started to teach myself how to play bass. And then I kind of had to ask my dad, I was like, hey, can I do this music course? He went, no, there's no future in music. And just because he was right doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, he should have fought me on going on the course as hard as he did. But eventually he kind of said, okay, fine, you can do that. And that didn't go very well, as it turns out. It was the first year they'd run this course. And there was just such a diverse array of people attending it. There was like me, I was 18. I'd been playing bass for about 6 months at that point, give or take. Wasn't particularly good at it. And then the opposite end of the spectrum, there was a lad on the course. His name was Nigel. He was 45 and he'd been playing bass for 30 years. So he didn't need to be on this course. He was just bored and needed something to do. So we're in these lessons and you've got like three or four kids like my age who are like there just like really slowly just like like plucking away at these basses trying to play songs, and he's just sat like just slapping bass in the corner like, this is really boring, what's going on, like come on kids, like keep up with me. And the teacher didn't know what to do. I did a year of it. I also started, you know, drinking quite heavily in the day because there was nothing to do between lectures, and which wasn't really conducive to learning, as it turns out. So that was kind of the end of my education. Like, I left music college, had no idea what I wanted to do, started doing a load of part-time jobs just because I needed some money. I'd moved out of home by then, so I was just doing random part-time jobs to kind of pay the bills. And I guess you could say I was just kind of just meandering through. I didn't really have any long-term goals or ambitions. I knew I still really, really liked music. Like, music was still like something that I was quite heavily involved in. I was going to like open mic nights. I was like trying to start bands with friends, but nothing ever really got off the floor. But it was just kind of very day to day, no long-term planning. I was not looking after myself at all, you know. And again, in hindsight, knowing what I know now, I thrive on routine. And there was no routine in my life at all. I was working random part-time jobs, different days every week. You know, some days I wasn't starting work till like 4 or 5 in the afternoon. Other days I was starting work at like 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. And it was not good for me. It was not good for me at all. Craig, this, my ex-girlfriend, my girl at the time, we joke about it now, but the first year or so we were together, because we started seeing each other kind of at this time. The first year or so we were together, her parents wouldn't let me into their house, which I at the time took really, really personally. And I kept asking her why, and she wouldn't tell me. And then after about a year, after they first invited me around, I was like, you need to let me know why I've not been allowed around before. And her parents had just watched this film called Trainspotting. And they were under the distinct impression that Rich may have had some substance abuse issues, which at the time I was like, how dare they? That is, wow. Like, I'm nice, I'm polite, I'm friendly, I'm definitely not on heroin. But then I saw some photos of me from when I was around 2021, and in hindsight, they were 100% correct. I think I was about 9 stone soaking wet. I was pale. I dyed my hair black for some reason. It didn't suit me at all. I looked deeply unwell, and I'm not the kind of person that you would have wanted in your home in any capacity. So now I'm like, yeah, that was really rude, but also quite correct. So yeah, it was a tricky one. Definitely a tricky one.
Fantastic. So this podcast is called Football Manager Therapy. It's a podcast about Football Manager. Where did it all begin? Not the game. Where it began for you?
This company called Sports Interactive. Now, before that, me, ironically, one of the constants throughout my life has always been, as we talked about earlier, has been football, and also variations on football management games. That's the side of things. And again, I think a lot of it ties into the neurodiversity aspect of things. I really like data. I love a good spreadsheet, you know. And Football Manager was a combination of the sport that I loved and just things that I also really, really enjoyed. So for me, I was like, okay, this is good. Oh, you can, you know, because I've played FIFA with friends, you know, I was like, that's fine. But suddenly here's a game where you can click on a player's name and I can just see all the statistics through their career. I can look at all the clubs they've played for. I can see the appearances they made, the goals. Oh, this is good. This is really, really, really good. Oh, there's somebody that's going to send me graphical analysis of how my city. Oh, this is even better. And that for me was just the thing. A lot of Champ Manager. Bizarrely, never on my own computer, because I'm one of these people. I didn't own my own laptop until I was in my mid-20s, which is weird because I'm only 24 now. So that's a couple of years away. But I didn't own my own laptop for years and years. So I'd play at friends' houses. Like I had friends, or I had my own Champ Man or Football Manager saves on their computers that they would just let me go around and play sometimes. Any console variation of a management game, I was all in on. I spent a couple of years just obsessed with the LMA Manager series. Like that was my jam for a good couple of years because it was there, it was on a console, it was incredibly stripped down compared to, you know, like your Football Manager or your Champ Managers, but I could play it at home in bed on my days off, and that was fine for me. So I got very, very, very into those. And then finally when I became a PC or a laptop owner at the time, the very first thing that I did was install, I think it was like Football Manager 2007, I think FM7. That was the first one I installed and just got so deeply invested in. And it just carried on from there. It just carried on from there because it's one of those games where I've never, especially when I was younger and definitely before content creation, I got the same level of enjoyment every single version of the game that I played. You know, it's only since kind of, you know, making content that I get the new game every single year. I was a, you know, skip a year or two. You know, if you look at my old Steam account, it was like, you know, FM9, FM11, FM14. You know, I'd skip two or three years every single time because I was like, I don't need the new game because I've got this save that I'm now, you know, 27 years into now. I'm just going to keep that going. This is fine. We'll just do that. But it's always been a constant. It's always been there. I think I had a Lille save a couple of years ago that I was blogging before I was making content. And I think one of the first things I talked about in that is that on a very, very old Champ Manager, I started with one of my cousins. He picked Liverpool for me because I was like, okay, fine, you could pick Liverpool. And I signed Oyonid Leonardson from Wimbledon, as they were at the time, on this save. And then the year after, in real life, Liverpool signed Oyonid Leonardson. And I was like, this is it. I'm obviously the greatest rubbish manager in football. He was awful. He was absolute dog water. But I was like, you know what? I've signed him now, and then they've signed him. So I feel validated, and I feel like I know what I'm doing in these games. I don't. If you've seen me stream, if you've seen the content I make, I clearly don't know what I'm doing. But, you know, that's always there. So no, Rich, you've got that very, very right. But yeah, it's been a constant, and it's been one that I've been really, really grateful for, I think.
So you have this love for football. You find Football Manager. Mm-hmm. You've spoken a little bit before on podcasts and other places that I've seen you speak about your stand-up stuff and then eventually leading into being a streamer. I'm aware that in a couple of days from now, there's a Twitch anniversary coming up, isn't there, for you? How many years is that since you first streamed?
2 years. So 2 years on Twitch. I think the day that this comes out publicly, so next Tuesday, that will be my second anniversary of streaming on Twitch. I'm going to celebrate it by gigging that night, so I won't be online.
Well, that's interesting. So I've heard a friend of the pod and lovely all-round guy, Tony Jameson, talk about the fact that stand-up stuff dried up through the pandemic and therefore he became a streamer, a content creator, because it was something that he could do and all that stuff. You sound as though you came to streaming a little bit after the pandemic, just a bit, not right in the middle of it. Is that fair?
Yes. Yeah.
So why? What made you decide to stream in the first place? Having done a little bit of stand-up, having, you know, tried your hand at a few other bits and pieces, what was it that made you decide, Football Manager, me, let's stream?
The simplest answer is Tony. That is the simplest answer. And when I say Tony, I mean I was told to start streaming by Tony. That was the long and the short of it. I think it was Tony's one of those people who I've met Tony in person once. Obviously we used to host the podcast together. Tony was one of those people who I've always been aware of Tony's work previously, through obviously his stand-up, obviously the FM tour that he did, Football Manager Ruined My Life. He was in the book. He's always somebody that I've been conscious of existing. Getting to know Tony through Matt was really, really, really cool. And then noticing that there were general similarities between myself and Tony, in as much as, he was stand-up, an exponentially more successful and better stand-up than me. And there's no question in that, because he just is. And then who then took his love of Football Manager, and then, after the podcast started, began streaming and just being perfectly suited to it. He has said himself multiple times, he tried YouTube wasn't the right platform for him. He went on Twitch, and then it just made sense. And it did, because he is correct. Twitch is 100% the correct platform for Tony. That Matt and Tony have always very, very, very nicely always referred to me in the early days as the third member of the pod, even though I wasn't kind of on screen. I was there behind the scenes and just chatting away to them about it. And it was lovely. And having, getting to know Tony through things like the Discord and just like chats that we would have and messaging each other, he was the leading expert. Like, he was the one that was like, mate, you need to start streaming. You will love this. Like, this is the right thing for you.
I was about to interrupt you when you were going to call Tony an expert, because he's definitely not an expert in streaming. he's getting really good now, but yeah, it was just almost.
Oh, at the time.
Me setting up 100%. Tony's first stream and then guiding through his first year of it was an experience, to say the least.
I can imagine it was. And, having been on the content creation side of things with him via podcasts, if it was a similar experience, we're both as bad as each other. Like, Tony and I are, we're both as bad as each other. I love him to death. He's a wonderful guy. And he just put the pressure on me. He was like, mate, you need to give this a go. You really need to give this a go, because it will, as you said, Kev, stand-up work had dried up throughout the pandemic. I was at home with a wife and, at the time, two small children, which was tricky at the best of times anyway. So I was just kind of, working very, very day to day again. I wasn't doing brilliantly through certain stages of lockdown, because I lost the structure. I lost my daily structure, and I wobbled, and I didn't have a great time some of the time. The rest of the time it was lovely. I had a cracking time, but some of it was difficult. The concept of streaming gave me a new thing to focus on. And it was as simple as that, really. He was like, you should really give it a go. I've talked frequently before about learning new skills fills me with terrible, terrible dread and anxiety. Mm-hmm. The concept of trying to set up my first stream petrified me. Like, Tony called me, the first time I spoke to Tony on the phone, he phoned me just to try and talk me through setting up a stream, which in hindsight was probably him repeating what Jeb had said to him over the phone. But when Jeb had said it to Tony, it probably made significantly more sense. But it was like, setting up Stream Chinese Whispers. It was like, right, okay, install this streaming software, Purple Monkey Dishwasher. I'm like, what? Huh? Okay. I think I might. And it was a mess. It was definitely the blind leading the blind. But he was the one that, I say, Tony put the pressure on me. He was like, at one point it was almost daily, like, are you going to start streaming now? You should start streaming. And it took a little while, and then I think when I officially decided to start doing it, as you said, Kev, the 2 year anniversary is coming up. The first stream I did was a Sheffield Wednesday stream. I did a Sheffield Wednesday save on FM21. But, and I've said before, one of my rules is I will not manage Sheffield Wednesday on Football Manager while the normal season is happening in real life, because genuinely can't handle the double misery. So I started it the day after we got relegated from the Championship in 2021. So, yeah, I think I decided I'm going to start streaming. I'm going to do Sheffield Wednesday. I'll do it the day after the season ends, because I'll either do a better job than they did in real life, or it'll be something. There'll be some kind of story there. So
please tell me you did a better job.
I did significantly better job. Yeah. Promoted inside three seasons with no budget. I'll have you know. I upset a lot of the people who are watching the stream. I got promoted because I screamed Billy Gilmore so loudly when he won us the championship playoff final against Newcastle. And Billy Gilmore scored in the 81st minute. And I got a little bit too loud. But fortunately, it was in the daytime and I didn't wake up any of my own kids, because Tony's done it before. I've definitely done it before. That's where, if you've ever watched the streams, that's where the little golf claps emote comes from. Because when I was streaming at night and I had the two younger kids that were asleep in bed, when we scored goals, the only way I could really celebrate was just, well done. Well done. Yep. That was a delightful 27-yard free kick. Yeah, so that's where that came from.
So that first Sheffield Wednesday save on stream, does that rank highly in most memorable moments on stream, that end point of winning stuff, or is there stuff that's kind of usurped it since? Where does that now rank?
No, I think it's always, I think because it was my first one, I think it's always going to, and because for the majority of it, it went really, really well. It's always going to hold a special place. I mean, from an actual quality of streaming point of view, from a, you know, tech side of things, it was the most horrible rinky-dink, like it was amateur hour quality at best. I'm not saying that it's improved much since, but you know, it was, the biggest stress I used to find was, am I going to be able to get through an entire stream without my internet cutting out? Because I was streaming from my bedroom in our old house, I had a Wi-Fi booster that you could plug an Ethernet cable into, but the Wi-Fi booster would once every couple of hours just go, right, I'm a Wi-Fi booster. I'm boosting that Wi-Fi. Ooh, something shiny. What was I doing? Then the internet would just cut out. And then 30 seconds later, oh, I was boosted the Wi-Fi. Oh, I'm going to reconnect now. But it would kill the stream. And, you know, there were streams that I started and stopped about six times because the results were really, really good. But it just kept cutting out. So the overall quality of it was terrible. But when the internet held up and my old PC held up, I was like, oh, this is actually just really, really good fun. It was, you know, at that time, I'm not ashamed to admit it, my audience were Tony's audience, because that was it. You know, Tony was brilliant in, he's like, hey, go watch this guy, he's my mate, he's worth a look. And I'm really, really grateful for that, because my audience at the time, like I say, were Tony's audience. Having a few people in the stream when we got that promotion to the Premier League was a really, really nice moment. That was really, really good fun, because you know, it just felt like the culmination of a lot of effort, or what felt like a lot of effort, into a stream save, trying to tell this story, you know, develop a bit of narrative, you know, with players like, you know, right, Barry Bannon, he wants Premier League football. We're going to get Barry Bannon Premier League football. You know, I've bought in Chris Brunt because I love Chris Brunt, club legend. He's back after 11 years. He's done his cruciate after two games, but he was still there. He was there momentarily. Those were the really nice moments, and like getting Wednesday into the Premier League and surviving season one, that was massive. I was like, this is gonna be really hard now. But then they gave me a transfer budget, which means I could actually buy players. I was like, oh, actually, this is going really well. And then it all falling apart in the fifth season again, just rage quitting the save was a memorable moment. You know, I think I was given a month to save the season, the dreaded, you've got until the end of this month to turn it around. I think they wanted, I think it was something like 10 points from the next like six or seven games. And I found myself in a position where I'd let Leeds go. I was dropping points left, right and centre. I think it was about 12:30 on a Tuesday morning. I had a full-on mental breakdown on stream and just thought, you know what, I'm going to play against, I think it was West Ham, and I was like, right, I'm going to set up a new tactic, and I'm going strikerless with five Trequartistas, and it's going to be the best thing that's ever happened. And then we won that game 1-0. So, oh, okay, this is not the outcome I was expecting. I was like, this is it, blaze of glory, five treks, we're going to get pumped 7-0, but at least I can say I went out on a high. Oh, we've won the game. oh, this is one. And then it got to the last game and I'd taken 7 points from six games. Last game, must win away from home against a mid-table team. And I just went, no, actually, I'm not emotionally prepared for this. I'm just going to quit the save by everybody and just kill the save. And that was the end of it. So, you know, dizzying highs, dizzying lows, but memorable moments, but definitely memorable moments with it. Say five Trek Artistas will forever stay there until I was thinking nobody's ever going to top it. And then I think friend of the pod, an all round excellent human being. I think Big Rogie did it with eight, but I think he was playing. I think he did eight treks, but I think three of them were technically strikers. So does it count? I don't know if that counts.
I don't even understand how that works personally, but okay.
Oh no, enough. Neither do I. It was as we were talking last week about I always base my my training or whatever else it is on the team's understanding of the tactic. Mm-hmm. And we'd kind of gone from we were playing like a narrow 4-1-2-1-2, but with wing backs, so moved up the pitch as a little bit more kind of aggressive defensively. Mm. And that was the formation, that was the system that kind of basically got us promoted. We've been relying on that quite a lot over the last few seasons. And I was like, I'm just going to move it all around. Five Trek Artistas, no strikers. And then just tactical understanding just died. It was like zero. And I was like, oh, it'll be fine. They'll all figure out Trek Artista stuff. And as it turned out, they did. I felt really, really smug because a couple of weeks before we'd done one of the first ever Tony Jameson versus the community draft nights. Mm-hmm. But he was just taking it in turns to just, play people in PvP games. And before he played me, he played Daljit, played Bust mm-hmm. the Net. And it was basically just like a tactical masterclass from Daljit. Not from Tony, bless him. But at one point, Tony made a joke about, four Trek Artistas on the pitch. And Dalger was like, oh, I've got a four Trek formation. Just pulled it up and then scored two goals past Tony with it. And I was like, well, actually, I think you'll find that in terms of tactical knowledge, tactical nous, Dalger, yesterday's news, mate, Rich has got five Trek Artistas. That's a moment. I've never done it since because it's a terrible idea, but at least I can say that I've done it. And that's technically, 100% win rate with it.
So I think we've basically reached full circle as to sort of currently where we are, but just very briefly on the podcast mm-hmm. side of things. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, you were the third member of a two-man team for a while, mm-hmm. And then you got the opportunity to be the second member of a two-man team.
Yes.
Did you consider saying no? Was it always a yes? Did you think immediately that's something I really want to do? What was your sort of basic thought of that moment?
So I think the best example I can give here of my decision-making process, Kev, is yourself. Because fast forward 6 months after I was offered the opportunity to join the pod with Tony, Tony got his incredible job offer from The Athletic. So he left pod. And it was handed to myself, and I was then charged with putting together a new team. If you don't know the story, Kev is the first person I approached because we'd had Kev on it. Kev was the second person I approached.
Callum just text me to say, what?
Callum was the first person. So I went to Kev and I let Kev know, because at the time Kev was the first person I think of outside of myself and Matt and I think Jeb as well that knew that Tony was leaving. Mm-hmm. So I kind of approached Kev and said, look, this is the situation. Tony is leaving pod, not for any horrible reasons, but Tony's leaving pod. I'm taking over. I'm putting together a new team. It felt like the start of a heist movie. I was like, hey, I'm putting together a team and I need a guy that can crack a safe and is dead sensible that everyone likes. Are you in? And Kev's
I said, have you asked Jebaroo?
He just said, don't ask Callum. It will upset the balance. But Kev's response to it was very, very measured. He was very flattered. But Kev said, can I have a couple of days just to think everything through and just and make sure I'm making the right choice, which was absolutely the right thing to do. When Tony offered me the podcast, I just went, yeah, okay. I was like, yeah, sure. Yeah, let's do this. The first thing I think actually I was, is this real? And then he was like, yeah. So are you interested? And then I just said a very big yes. And then I was like, oh, we'll figure out the logistics of how this works afterwards. So I was like, yeah, no problem at all, because that is how Tony and I ran this podcast together. So yeah, it wasn't, I was incredibly flattered. It sounds like it can't be true, but I had zero idea. I had zero inkling that it was coming. It, you know, at that point I'd done a couple of Patreons with Matt and with Tony. I think not long before that we'd recorded the infamous Daily Blind date that never made it to air, which was the Patreon episode where Matt played the role of an ambiguous Northern game show host, and Tony and I were blind date characters who were also footballers, and then we had to try and figure out who each other were. And it just showed mine and Tony's awful brain connection, because the footballer he chose to be was Anthony van den Boer. And he got all the clubs mixed up, got all of his information mixed up, but I still correctly guessed that he was Anthony van den Boer. which I don't know if that was one of the contributing factors to us just completely melting Matt's head as he tried to edit it, but that episode never made it out, because I think it was just too much and there was too much nonsense. But I'd done a couple of Patreons with Matt and Tony and had a really, really nice time doing it, because I was like, oh, this is just great, because my friends do this thing and my friends want me to be part of it, and this is brilliant. And then when Tony got in touch and said, look, this is the situation, are you interested? I genuinely had no idea it was coming. It would have probably been, when he phoned me, I was like, this is the last thing that he's going to say to me. Like, I did not expect it in any way, shape, or form, because I think they'd been on, I think they'd taken a little hiatus at that point, and it was probably not long before they're coming. I was expecting him to say, oh, just so you know, mate, podcast is coming back in a few weeks' time. That's the kind of call I was expecting, which wasn't the one. But I said yes very, very quickly. Did not think about the logistic repercussions of it at all. Did not think about the technological repercussions of it at all, having a very old and broken and loud PC. I just said yes, because I was just flattered more than anything else. I just didn't see myself doing it, because there are so many people out there that, and I've said this before on pod, I've said it on stream, you know, especially Kev and Sos Jeb, but Callum as well, but also you too, Jeb. You are all very articulate people. You are all incredibly articulate. I am not, so me hosting a podcast makes zero sense to me. But you know what I lack in articulation, I hope I make up for in enthusiasm. But yeah, it was very, very, very flattering, a very wonderful opportunity to have been given, and I am eternally grateful for it.
I would counter that thought by saying that I've just spent an hour in your company listening to you speak about all sorts of things, and I thought it was very articulate, so you don't know what you're talking about. So there you go, that's that one. I kind of think we're kind of at the point where everybody now knows, really, that, you know, we've now got this team together, we're now moving the podcast forward. Do you have any thoughts just briefly about what the pod looks like moving forward? Is there any big master plan in that big brain of yours, or is it just kind of as we've determined through this last hour or so, maybe just kind of chuck it at the wall and see what happens?
No, it's a meticulous planner.
I think we have accidentally, I couldn't be happier with the group of people that I have on board with me on podcast. Genuinely couldn't have been happier. I said it early doors, the original lineup of the pod that we had, when I was given the reins by Tony and by Matt, the first three people that I said I would want involved on this podcast with me would be Kev, would be Alice, and would be Jeb. And I was incredibly grateful to have, even though it was only for a short while, to have had all three of you on pod together. That was brilliant. After Alice left, I think we moved on. I say moved on isn't the right word, but I think we adapted, and then I think the three of us became a really, really good group. By the way, I'm incredibly grateful to Alice for her contributions as well. I think that's very, very important to say. We love Alice. And you know, Alice wasn't here for a long time, but Alice was here for a good time. So I really, really enjoyed those early records with Alice. They were brilliant fun, and we absolutely adore Alice. She's brilliant. But then the three of us, I think, kind of, you know, we found our way. And then again, sorry, Jeb, but like adding Callum, like that's been brilliant as well. You know, when you know, it's rare at the moment that just because of everybody's scheduling and Jeb being so busy and Callum being at a wedding, you know, when the four of us are together, I think it's really, really wonderful. So I am really, really, really excited about the future of podcast. I think the dynamic works brilliantly. Having lost Alice, we all kind of, you know, Callum was the logical replacement, and I'm so glad that Callum is able to be part of the podcast in the long run as well. Moving forwards, I mean the sky's the limit. I think we've kind of, you know, we found our place. I like the fact that we are community driven. I really enjoy the fact that, you know, we like to highlight stuff like the PvP side of things, the fact that we've had Callum on as a guest before he then eventually joined the pod, having people like Llama on. We've got other guests that we have confirmed, we're confirming dates with, that we're moving forwards with, that we're going to get on, which I'm really, really excited about getting to sit down and chat to with everybody. I think the future of the podcast is looking bright. And just as a, just going to plant the seed here, boys. Mm-hmm. We might have had a little conversation over the last week or so about the possibility of another live show. That's all I'm going to say at this point. But the gears are very, very, very slowly starting to turn.
You what?
So just what? Hey? Oh, yeah, Jeb.
So, Jeb.
Probably going to do a live show.
chat after, yeah.
Well, oh, yeah. We'll have a chat after. Oh, you might be doing a live show, Jeb. Don't tell anybody else, though. It's just between us.
Okay.
Just between us.
And but it's next week. No.
It's next week.
It's really not.
No. Can you imagine? But no, I'm excited because for me, the biggest thing is that every week I genuinely look forward to getting to sit down and just chat to my friends. And that for me is enough. So that's brilliant. That's the thing that I think I enjoy about this whole process the most. The fact that we get really, really nice correspondence, get really, really nice feedback about the episodes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, really nice that people are still finding the podcast and enjoying the podcast. That means the world. I know it means the world to me. And I think I'd be surprised if it was different for you guys. But the fact that we're able to do that, we're reaching new people and people are enjoying what we do, that's just an added bonus because I enjoy what we do. And if other people are doing that as well, good.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you for opening up. Thank you for letting us know some stuff about you. I think it was really important that as we move forward, we kind of get an opportunity to express something of who we are as individuals within the team, just to let everybody know who listens as to, you know, who we are and where we come from and what all that looks like. So thank you for that. Unless Jeb's got anything else, I'm happy to hand you back the reins of your own podcast, you know, and go and give you an opportunity to move us towards the end of it. But yeah. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It was really interesting.
What's your favourite biscuit?
Ooh.
That's a big question.
I saved the big one till last.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've gone big. Right. So if there is a cup of tea involved and I'm placing the biscuit into the tea, it's a chocolate hobnob. 100%. 100%. If there's no cup of tea involved and I'm going in dry, probably... a jammy dodger. I rate a jammy dodger. Underrated biscuit, but not good for dunking. Not a good dunking biscuit, a jammy dodger.
Okay.
Not structurally sound enough.
So that's just divided the community completely, and we'll have correspondence about that all week as to how wrong Rich is, but it's okay. Yeah, we love him anyway. Yeah. It's fine.
This is it. We've had, like, after our episodes recently, there's been just such great chat in the community about you know, there's been conversations about, you know, tactics and how we set up tactically. There's been conversations about you know, how we present our content to each other. It's going to be biscuits this week. It's all going to be biscuits. Oh,
it's gosh. Somebody biscuits does it. In my stream every somebody, day.
There's going to be tier lists everywhere, aren't there? There's going to be really upsetting tier lists. So we're all going to fall out with each other. But then we'll all make up in time for next week's pod. There we go. God, it feels weird me saying this now. But fellas, don't know about the two of you, but I reckon that's a podcast.
Oh, it's not quite. There are a couple of things that we need to talk about. One being for our Patreons, who are going to be listening to this Monday. You will catch us Monday evening for the Network Save, and we're going to be rounding it up for the end of season one. And I'm hopefully going to stay in the Premier League, and hopefully those two guys are going to get European football and all those kinds of lovely things. So that's the first thing to say. So anybody listening to it Tuesday onwards, come and watch a VOD or something and catch up with what happened on the last day of the season within the the network save. So that was the first thing. Can you remember what the second thing is? Now that I can. Handed you back the reins?
I absolutely can. So, slight amendment to the plans we announced a couple of weeks ago. A couple of pods back, we announced the return of FMT versus the community. The third installment, the completion of the trilogy. There's going to be more. It's not a trilogy at all. It's going to be like Star Wars, but the next trilogy is going to be based on, we'll do it on like FM 11 or something. It'll be brilliant. But we had originally announced the date of the 21st of May for the next FMT versus the community. It's now going to be the week after. So it's going to be Sunday the 28th. So if you are... Hello, Jeb.
And I still can't defend my title, sorry.
Still can't, sorry.
I refuse to defend it now. I'm going to have to be good
all of a sudden.
So whoever wins is the interim champion. That's how it's going to work now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how it works. It's now going to be, it's got the WWE vacant graphic. That's going to be the title holder for the next couple of weeks. Good old vacant. What a career they've had. 28th of May. If you want to come and play some Football Manager with us, just get in touch via the Discord, get in touch via the YouTube, tweet us, whatever you do, however you want to communicate that with us, let us know and come and do some drafting with us on the evening of the 28th of May. And we'll have a lovely time. Lovely time is guaranteed by all.
Now that feels like a podcast.
That feels like a podcast to me. There it is. You smashed it. If you don't have a lovely time, by the way, then you're doing it wrong. There we go. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've talked loads, which feels weird for me. I've talked loads, but I've had a really nice time doing it. Thank you for that, boys. That was really cathartic. Really nice. That was a great idea. That was Kev's shout, by the way, this week's episode. So I liked that a lot. Before we go, Jeb, you mentioned that you're not going to Berlin for a little while. And you said before we went live, you might be doing a bit of streaming this week. If you were going to be doing that, mate, where can the people find you?
I need to look it up. I can't remember. twitch.tv/Jebberoo. Also the Jebberoo on Twitter. Less travel stuff on the Twitter this week, so that'll be interesting. But also, shout out to you right there. I'm pointing, and I'm also audibly pointing. There you go. Audibly pointing at you. Give us a like, give us a subscribe, tell your friends, do it that way. We've had some really nice feedback over the last couple of weeks, and let's keep it up, let's keep it going. Let's keep this FMT trainer rolling. Kev, where can we find you?
You can find me at the United City FM, both on Twitter and Twitch. I'm on Twitch every weekday afternoon, 3 till 5 p.m. Last week, I created and scheduled my training in-game on Thursday's live stream of last week. Come and see this week as to whether my players all revolt against me and tell me that it's dreadful and my entire club falls apart or not. Because at this moment, I genuinely don't know what's going to happen with that. It might be brilliant, it might be awful, but it was fun to do. So come and find me every weekday afternoon on Twitch. Rich, where can people find you, my friend?
Oh, you can find me, twitch.tv/RichOwensFM. A couple of weeks ago, we started the Scandinavian Triple Crown Challenge. I've been away for a week on dog duty for family, so I haven't been streaming. That will be recommencing this week, where I will definitely spend a bit of time setting up a training schedule. So if you want to see that with some Scandinavian footballers, I know a stream for you. It's mine. Come and watch it. Just to reiterate what Jeb said as well, thank you so much for your recent feedback and your lovely comments, everything else. It's been really nice. We do appreciate it. But click all the buttons. Click all the follow buttons. Click all the subscribe buttons. Share it with your pals. Tell your mam about it. She might like it. She might be well into this. You never know. Maybe that's a new demographic that nobody in the FM community has unlocked yet. Mums. Who knows? We could be huge on Mumsnet. I hope we are. But, fellas, I've had a great time. Thank you again. And thank you. Thank you for hanging out and spending some time and listening to us. We appreciate you. Thank you very much. This has been another really, really enjoyable episode of Football Manager Therapy. We will see you on the next one. Take care. Love you lots. Bye-bye.